Welcome on to a Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. And actually, for the first time in a while, I'm going to do a little bit of a game breakdown. Joining me to do so, Seth Partnow, all from not-so-sunny Alaska.
The sun came out today. It was just wicked cold when it did.
How much daylight are you getting in these wee months?
Oh, at least 4 hours.
How far north do you have to go before you have a time period where you don't get any sunrise at all?
You probably have to go about 400 miles north of Anchorage. So kind of Arctic Circle area. I occasionally go up to Barrow, Alaska for work, and that's all the way up on the north coast, and that's fully in the no daylight for, you know, the 30 days of night was, I believe, set in Barrow. Or somewhere around there. So that's, yeah. But not in Anchorage. We actually get sunlight.
All right. Well, I guess the sun is setting on the career of Kobe Bryant now.
Oh, dear.
After his somewhat expected and announcement that he's going to retire, seemed like a decision that had been made some time ago, but was revealed on the Players Tribune. But is, you know, I think we've kind of beaten a dead horse on where Kobe is now as a player, but I want to try and put his career in perspective a little bit. I mean, just what are some of your general thoughts about him as a player just over the course of his career?
He is, to me, so first of all, I should be upfront with my bias. I grew up a Celtics fan, and to the extent I still have lingering fandom, it's mostly of the Celtics. So my opinions on Kobe Bryant aren't completely rational, and they obviously tend towards the negative, because, which is honestly, it's a pretty high compliment if you think about it. Like, if you're a lifetime Laker and Celtics fans hate you, then you probably did something right, right? But from a more objective standpoint, he's a guy who the classic case of like the best thing about him also being the worst thing about him. You know what I mean? Like the drive and confidence and all that stuff, which, you know, not terribly unlike Jordan, although manifesting itself more on the negative side for Kobe, I think, is that the, you know, the ability to take any shot and think that's the best thing that should happen often got in the way of it being the right shot. But at the same time, it was the right shot often enough that he was, you know, one of the most terrifying opposition players of all time. And you know, I'm sure we'll argue where he settles in historically, but certainly kind of inner pantheon, you know, I'm probably lower on him historically than a lot of people, but he top 20 easily. And then we can, you know, kind of nitpick from there where exactly he settles in amongst, like, the, you know, the all-timiest of all-time greats.
You know, the interesting thing about Kobe to me, and let's start with the beginning, that he is really, really, really good. And despite what you may say about the aesthetics of his game, I mean, he was really a contradiction, because from a skill standpoint, what he could do in the air when he was younger, some of the acrobatics, some of the classic dunks that he had, the way he was able to defend when motivated, all of those things were beautiful aesthetically, yet for people who kind of love team basketball, it was almost vexing in a way to see that there would be one guy who sometimes could actually beat teams that played much better basketball in the way that you wanted them to play it. But nonetheless, you could say Kobe, you know, what was so vexing about it is that his style of play, at least for much of his career, was very, very effective. The Lakers, even during their down years, they only had 1 year where they're out of the top 10 in offense during his prime, which I'll describe as 1999 to 2013, when he tore his Achilles and he had a very long prime. The fact that they only had 1 year out of the top 10 in offense during that entire period shows that even though he himself was not incredibly efficient, he was able to drive some teams that had relatively limited talent aside from him, you know, other than the Shaq years, to being really great offensive teams, especially if you look at that interregnum between Shaq and Gasol.
Sure. Though one thing you said there is interesting is, you know, the notion of kind of, quote, better basketball. And this is, you know, there's maybe a lesson here in that a lot of, like, this is a point I think we've both touched on occasionally over the last however long. But, you know, the point of a lot of these fundamental things is, you know, the quote-unquote fundamentals is you do it this way because, you know, no one person, you know, one person doing it all himself can't. And that's why these are the fundamentals. Well, you know, you get to the NBA and those start to relax a little bit. And then in truly special cases like, you know, LeBron, Kobe, KD, Jordan, stuff like that, they kind of can. And so, like, the necessity for what is, I agree with you, a more aesthetically pleasing style of more team-oriented basketball, in terms of effectiveness, it kind of falls away a little bit. So, you know, I think that's almost a way of people mistaking what they would prefer aesthetically for what was actually, you know, brutally effective, but still effective.
Part of what actually was so frustrating for me about Kobe is I think that he actually could have been better than he was if he had taken just a slightly different offensive approach. If he had focused more on moving without the ball, like if you compare some of the shots that he took compared to the shots that like late career Jordan would take, you would just get so many more shots from moving without the ball. And yeah, he'd take some tough ones off the dribble, especially late in the clock, especially late in games. But to me, what makes you such a good scorer for most players is you use your talent and you use your physical ability and you use your smarts to get better shots than other players can get. And I felt like if Kobe had just skewed a little bit more towards that, instead of taking the tough jumpers that, you know, granted he was perhaps the most effective at ever in NBA history as a bad shot maker, maybe he could have been even better. Maybe he could have been a guy who would have had, you know, a 600 true shooting percentage every year.
I, you know, to be honest, I think that he's probably in his prime. I think he probably, just remembering back, specifically if you remember I think it was a documentary Spike Lee made about him. And it was mostly kind of a propaganda piece, but there were parts of it.
The only thing I remember from that is that he like really liked to rub his hands on his own jersey so they'd be wet so he could handle the ball better. I found that the most enlightening nugget from that documentary.
The part I found it was super intriguing was, you know, just kind of the battles between him and Bruce Bowen about him trying to do those things you're talking about, and, you know, Bowen being, you know, the clutchy, grabby, excellent defender that he was, not really letting him. But I think he, you know, in his prime, certainly with Shaq, and also even with kind of the Powell, Lamar Odom teams, he did a fair amount of, you know, kind of rim run, post a guy out, get an easy look that way, you know, maybe make a backdoor play. It's just he shot so much that the proportion of them were that became kind of the shake 'em up elbow jumper kind of thing is kind of skewed in our mind. So I think he did do some of that. It just he did so much of the other thing, which I think you kind of have to do to just get the volume of shots up that he did.
You know, it's also important to remember too that in the era where he really cut his teeth, it's not like there's some like amazing aesthetic going on. You know, there's the 99 Spurs were the team that they struggled to get past at first. You know, that team, you know, was long before Greg Popovich really opened things up and emphasized ball movement and three-point shooting. It was let's post up Tim Duncan, you know, and then draw a double team and then, you know, then maybe we'll kick it out to three-point shooters, you know, play at a slow pace, et cetera, et cetera. And it really wasn't until the Kings, and then later the Suns, that things began to open up a little bit. But I will remember probably the time that I was most back when I was more of a fan, was most annoyed by the way that Kobe played was Game 6 of the 2010 Western Conference Finals, when that Suns team that might be, you know, one of the most beautiful playing teams ever, ended up losing to him because he just hit a million impossible fadeaway 21-footers from the right wing over Grant Hill and just, you know, beat that Suns team on their own floor in Game 6 of the West Finals. And I was just, it bothered me because this is just like, all right, you know, watching this, there's nothing that you can really do. It's not fun to be his teammate watching him. And yet I hated to see that rewarded. And that ultimately, you have to acknowledge the greatness of that to play in that way and still be effective and still win championships.
So this is ironic because we're going to talk about the Warriors later. But like, what's the thing that like makes them go is kind of Steph's ability to do that, right? And we saw it a little bit tonight, and we'll get there. But it's just funny that you know that if in a slightly different circumstances, I guess you know.
Yeah, I know where you're going with this, and actually I thought of this as I started talking because you know Steph hit some ridiculous shots tonight, right? Which were one-on-one bad shots for anyone else in NBA history. Part of that is just that it's a three, so it's a little bit more efficient. But also, you know, the large part of his game is he plays on a team that averages more assists than anyone else in the NBA, and he gets a lot of his shots off ball movement, off moving without the ball, you know, off his teammates finding him, setting good screens. It just looks better. And also, he's just, you know, a different kind of personality as well, which I think kind of plays into things. So, yeah, I do see your point that, you know, Kobe gets chastised for this. You know, someone like Steph maybe gets a little bit more of a free pass. But, you know, I do think there are enough of the differences that I don't feel much about.
Oh, no, not at all. Because I think the personality is really a big part of it. And the other, you know, to not really making a segue here, but the other thing to note, I think, is Kobe is far from the last player. There's kind of a generation of wing scorers in the NBA. The two that pop immediately into my mind are like Rudy Gay and DeMar DeRozan, who are kind of laboring under their game being developed with that being the idea of that's what, quote unquote, the man on the wing does. Is that kind of offense, that kind of very, I have the ball, I'm going to get us a bucket kind of offense. And while the league has moved away from that, it's not like players who have, you know, spent 15 years of their basketball learning lives honing those skills can suddenly change them overnight. Some can, some can't. You know, a guy like,
yeah, and that's the fact that Kobe is able to do all this
right
one-on-one in a way that really no one could stop when he really had it going. I mean, that's why I think you see players admire him so much in a way that, frankly, is outsized for how good he was. Despite the fact that he was really, really good, you know, the fact that he is, you know, probably most people consider him as, like, way better than Tim Duncan, which I think is ridiculous, frankly. You know, it just shows that the way he played captured the imagination of a lot of players, and obviously he played for the Lakers, and it captured the imagination of a lot of people who love to see basketball as this mano a mano duel, and you know, I think that appeals to anyone who's ever played.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, so where do you kind of, what do you think of him historically? What do you think is sort of fits with what the conventional wisdom is about him, and what maybe, you know, might be over or even underrated about his career?
I think it's the thing that's underrated about his career is, you know, his passing. It's kind of like, you know, the indelible image of him is, even before kind of this season, was kind of the selfish gunner. But for, you know, his career, he was really, especially when motivated to be so, an excellent, excellent passer. Part of it was because, you know,
another aspect that kind of made things more frustrating when he'd play the way he did, though.
Right, like what is, if you said, what is the, in my mind, the singular Kobe play is the the first play I'll ever think of when I'm thinking of him play will be the lob he threw to Shaq against Portland in the, was it the 2000 Western Conference Finals?
Yeah, yeah, Game 7 of the 2000 West Finals. Like, that kind of salted away that 15-point comeback in the fourth quarter.
And which is, you know, now that it's less ironic now that they've kind of buried the hatchet, but it was still like that being the main image, considering, you know, the ups and downs of their own relationship over the year. That's probably the first play I'll think of for both of those players. But yeah, that's one thing that, and also, as you mentioned, like the fact that he was, you know, legitimately all NBA level defense for much of his early prime before, you know, especially when the Lakers were a better team and he could use more energy on that.
Yeah. And he didn't deserve, you know, probably the last five all defense selections that he got, I would say. But yeah, he did have the ability to turn it up like crazy. I mean, and I think a lot of it was just that team did as well. I mean, their transformation defensively in that 2001 playoffs being a perfect example of that.
Yeah. And he had that up until, you know, fairly recently. You sensed he had that extra gear to go to defensively.
All right, so where do you think he ranks historically among two guards and sort of as an all-time player? To me, it's a very interesting question because as spectacular as he was, he gets most of his points for me for longevity more than peak, because I don't know that there was really more than one season where he was ever indisputably the best player in the NBA.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, being among the... This is a tough conversation to have just because some of it is inextricably linked to kind of, you mentioned earlier, kind of his defensive reputation lingered maybe a couple seasons longer than it should have in terms of overall. And, you know, the fact that we were still having, you know, LeBron or Kobe arguments, you know, or those arguments were still being had.
Or that like people would talk about as late as like 2012 that he was the best player in the game. I mean, that was just ridiculous that people were saying that at that point.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's hard to not react so strongly against that, to like color what came before. So,
I mean, like what year should he, I thought 06, he probably had a pretty good case that he should have been the MVP. I don't really think there was another year where, if you're really looking at any objective criteria, that he should have won MVP.
I think that's probably right.
Like 08, when he won it, I thought it should have been Chris Paul for sure. Chris Paul had like the highest PER ever by a point guard and took a New Orleans team that had essentially nothing else to 56 wins and the number two seed that year.
It's quite possibly Steve Nash included, quite possibly the greatest season by a point guard ever. So it's Steve Nash.
You got to go back to Magic to be. I don't know about that. I mean, I think Magic was so good for so long that you probably would have to give him the edge with some of those MVP seasons in the late 80s. But yeah, I mean, that was an unbelievable 08 season for Chris Paul. I thought he definitely got robbed in that year.
But you're right. But at the same time, I mean, if you're doing some kind of, you know, okay, you get X points for first place and, you know, Y for second and so on down the list. I mean, you know, he maybe wasn't there, but I mean, it's kind of like if you're talking about the greatest actor of all time, you know, who's better? Someone who, you know, Tom Hulce, who won for Amadeus and was never heard of again, or someone who, that's a reference, or, you know, someone who's been nominated for, you know, 12 Oscars without actually winning one.
Remind me to never play trivia with you, by the way.
I mean, if you didn't,
unless it's Simpsons trivia,
if you didn't, I mean, I'm guessing you could have probably figured that already. Useless knowledge is not a weakness of mine, sadly. But which of those would you say was it better, right? You know, it's like, you know, in terms of...
No, it's all somewhat from your point of view. Let me ask you this. Would you agree with me that Dwayne Wade had a better peak than Kobe Bryant did?
Huh. I actually haven't
done that. I say that he did.
That's a good... I think they're probably comparable in terms of... of like absolute peak. I will say that, you know, if you're talking apex, like Tracy McGrady's, was it the 2003 season of McGrady?
Yeah, when he averaged 32 games like, for Orlando.
Yeah, like his peak was for that, you know, that's that single season was probably better than any of Kobe's single seasons, for example. But that you would never say that Tracy McGrady was a better player, had a better career. So,
yeah, no, that's true.
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, when would you consider like what are you considering Wade's peak?
Well, so
like,
so this
like
is my thought.
2006 or 2008?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So in 2006, Wade had maybe the best finals that anyone has ever had. Kobe never really had.
Everyone from what? Dallas just shut this podcast off. And but anyway,
well, Kobe never really had an incredibly dominant single playoff run or incredibly dominant NBA Finals performance the way that Wade did. And I think that Wade's 2009 and 2010 also were better regular seasons than Kobe had ever as well. I mean, I think he was like 30 PR both those years, was a better distributor. You know, I think all those things are kind of true. But Wade, you know, really his last great season was 2011 as a regular season. So, you know, I think you would be hard-pressed to argue that Wade ultimately had a better career than Kobe. And Kobe, I mean, his longevity, you know, there's probably an eight-season stretch or so where it's hard to argue he wasn't a top-five player in the league every year. And maybe even like a 12-season stretch where he was a top-10 player in the league every year. And you'd be hard-pressed to find many other players who had that sort of longevity.
I mean, aside from the player you mentioned earlier, who Tim Duncan, who
Tim Duncan, though, I wouldn't say that he was a top 10 player in the league past maybe like 2009, 2010.
Yeah, that's.
And now, granted, that's probably 12 years. That's 98 to 2010.
And also, you also to some degree, that's a choice that we're seeing the benefits of now, I think.
But he only had his minutes really cut in 07 was the first year. Before that, he was playing like, you know, 38 minutes a game every year. So he had plenty of opportunities.
But again, you know, through last year, if you looked, you know, kind of per minute, it's like it's the same year every year, basically from... I think it's probably his scoring, especially, is probably down a little this year. But other than that, like,
but there's still that's different though. People say that, and I always kind of rail against it because when you're putting up those numbers, A, in a lower offense era, B, as the primary offensive impetus on your team, it means much more than if you're kind of doing it as like, all right, you know, I'm
fine,
the third
fine.
You're not wrong.
Yeah,
but like, let's not say, all right, he's just as good as he was back then. That's just not true.
He's closer to that good as he has any right to be at his age.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. So I guess ultimately to wrap this up, since we've been talking about him for a long time, but he's, you know, he's interesting to talk about, even for us who are not, you know, the biggest aesthetic fans of his game. Yeah, I think he's more kind of a top 15. Top 20 player of all time, because he really, it's just, if you're looking at it from any kind of objective statistical standpoint, whether it's his team performance, whether it's his own performance, it's difficult to argue that he was, other maybe than one year, the best player in the league at any given time. And with that being the case, you know, it's hard to put him in the top 10 as a player.
Right, and it's, I mean, as, you know, people get, like, up in arms about that kind of stuff, but then you, like, start naming names, and it's just like, oh, that's who you have to be, like, you can be a super era snob and say, well, you know, Wilt, Kareem, Oscar Robertson, you know, they played back when it was, you know, prehistoric basketball, so they don't count, and if you're going to do that, then that's fine, but that's a different discussion. So, but the, you know, you're... It's a pretty, at the top, the mountain gets pretty steep pretty quick. And these are, you know, kind of the, if it sounds like we're nitpicking, that's because we are. It's because that's kind of what happens when you reach that kind of that territory of inner circleness.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, Seth, when you go to play basketball, what kind of shoes do you wear?
Basketball shoes.
You would not say wear running shoes. That would be quite foolish, right?
Well, I did that at Summer League and sprained my ankle and basically couldn't walk for 3 weeks, so yes.
Ah, that's bad. So you probably also then, if you're going to play basketball, it's a good idea to wear basketball socks. You can get, especially if you haven't played in a while, you know, maybe your calluses kind of break down a little bit, you can very easily get some blisters, get some chafing, and Stance socks are a great way to avoid that because they have moisture-wicking technology. They have padding in the places that you need it where your foot hits the shoe. I played in them after having taken quite a while off, and my feet were good as new the next day. They're fantastic, and now the official sock provider of the NBA, these socks look great in person. And I think they looked really good on the Bulls today when I covered them at the UC, which we'll get to. That game, all of them were wearing the new socks and looked really good in them. And you could also look just as good, whether it's for Christmas or just buying them for yourself to go out and play. Probably the best sock brand out there. You can look good, feel great while you're playing, or just get some of the great NBA hardwood classic designs, anything else to support your team in a way that, you know, works okay when even when you're, you know, wearing something that's a little dressier. So wear what the pros wear and go to stance.com. If you are not wearing Stance, you're just wearing socks. All right, should we get to the main event here? Golden State, Utah, which was a fantastic game among two teams that I really, really enjoy watching with a lot of great players.
This was really good basketball down the stretch, especially. It was a lot of fun.
You G-chatted me, and I figured I would just save it. You said you loved what Utah did in this game. Why was that?
So this is something it's kind of hard to talk around, but it's that everyone's always talking about, well, how do you match up with Golden State? And if that's the only question you're asking, you lose because you play like, all right, well, with a small ball lineup, we got to put all of our small guys on the floor and then try to run around and chase. It's like, well, you lose because that's their game, you know? And Utah was like, you know what? Okay, they're going to get their looks that way. We're our two of our three best players are Rudy Gobert and Derek Favors. They are on the court because they are two of our three best players. And
well, so let me interrupt you there for a second because Golden State obviously did not deploy the death lineup because Barnes is out. He's going to be out for, it sounds like, weeks now with the sprained ankle. He, for all that people want to complain about him, he is an absolute essential component to that. And so I don't think we really even saw what happened because, A, Golden State didn't play Green at center very much, at least in the second half, which is what I concentrated on. And they also didn't have Barnes out there as well, so, you know, who I think is someone they would have had on Gobert and had Green on Favors. So I don't know. I mean, I see your point, and I like that their players are real good, and I wouldn't take them off the floor necessarily either without at least trying it. But this was not necessarily like quite a fair litmus test.
Oh, I'm not saying that I liked it just because it worked, though it did. And you're right. There's a caveat that it wasn't like the death line, the Death Star was not fully operational tonight.
Fully armed and operational, I believe is the quote.
Oh boy, soon. but just the fact that they, you know, this is. If we're going to lose, we're going to lose playing the way we play. And it's a little bit like, you know, to make a football analogy, it's, you know, the coaches who, all right, well, I'm going to punt here on fourth down, even though to win the game, I should go for it because at least I'll lose slower that way. And that it feels like trying to match up and get out of like what we being the opposition do to take them on is just a way to yeah, fine, you maybe get run out of the building less often, but you're also going to have a hard time winning because you're going to have, you know, your best lineup is not going to be on the floor at the end of the game because you're trying to match up. And so then even if you manage to keep it close, you're at a huge disadvantage at the end of the game and you lose. Whereas at least Utah is giving themselves their best chance to win should it come down there. And, you know, again, it's being completely results oriented, but they're right there. And you have to say that it was in large part because, you know, fine, Golden State did Golden State things, but, you know, Rudy Gobert is also blocking shots all over the place, and Derek Favors is putting people in the basket.
It doesn't work just because, oh, these are big guys we're leaving on the floor. It works because those guys are quick.
Yes.
Favors, you know, granted, Steph hit one shot on him late, and then Favors, I thought, actually bothered him pretty decently on the other one when they switched onto him. But Favors is one of the few guys that actually can stand a decent shot. Maybe you could put Ibaka in that category and AD as well, as really the only traditional bigs in the league that you probably would feel comfortable. Maybe you could say Capella if he gets a little bit more experience. But as guys who are traditional bigs that could actually guard Steph in that situation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, you know, defensively, you're going to give yourself some problems by doing that. But defensively, you're going to have problems because Golden State is a wonderful offensive team. So you almost take the fact that you're going to have defensive problems as a given and give them some problems at the other end. And you know, make the mismatches both ways instead of making it, okay, we're not going to give them anything to worry about on offense, but we'll make our defensive mismatches slightly less bad for us, which seems to be of the more almost fearful route that a lot of teams are starting to take against Golden State. And that's, you know, you've kind of already lost if you're in that sort of reactive mode, I feel like.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think you have to at least give it a shot with some of your best guys. Now, if you have a whole playoff series to deal with that lineup, then I think you can try some things, especially try some things out in the regular season and kind of see. But if you're just some random, you know, Wednesday during the course of the season and you're a team that's not necessarily going anywhere, I think you got to at least try it, especially if one of your best guys is a big. If you just have, all right, we normally play bigs, but these guys aren't that good, then yeah, go ahead and downsize. You might as well. But yeah, so let's a couple of observations that I had in this game. One is that I touched on this. I think Golden State is really going to miss Barnes, and mostly they're going to miss him on that second unit. The second unit did not play particularly well in the second half, especially. They went with Spates at the four and Bogut at the five, and that unit got smashed in about 4 minutes. I think they were minus nine. And Utah didn't help matters by bringing back maybe at least their best scorer, Gordon Hayward, to go against that Golden State bench unit. And I think without being able to play small on that second unit with the spacing that Barnes provides at the four, those guys are not going to be particularly effective when Steph is out of the game.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's, you know, something you've kind of talked about a fair amount is, you know, the better offensive players around him, the more useful a player Bogut is, especially just because he's not necessarily a guy who can create anything, but he can create for others a little bit by, you know, his screening and passing and stuff like that.
Azealia's way better than Bogut right now. You think so?
Draymond Green at center is so much better than both of them that, you know, I think it's somewhat matchup dependent, but I think against them, that's tough. You got me at a loss there.
Well, all right. So this is my argument for that. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the offensive rebounding that Azili has is something that Bogut doesn't necessarily do. Bogut's okay at the alley-oops, but he can't just go get it the way Azili can. And that really opens things up on that Draymond Green sort of two-on-one. Utah actually did a pretty good job, about as good as you're going to do, on those two-on-ones. They made Green shoot a lot. He actually had a 35% usage in this game and was not particularly efficient because they just had Gobert standing under the hoop and said, all right, Draymond Green, you want to try and shoot a floater over me? Fine. you know, I'm the best guy in the league to be the one in that two-on-one between you and Azeeley or you and Bogut. Bogut, despite playing most of his minutes with the starters on the year, is has an 8.9 net rating, which obviously is still really good, but is basically anybody else who plays big minutes for them is like well into double digits. So that's another. I mean, and it's not like he's playing with the same guys, so it's not like there are caveats there, but they are not playing as well with him on the floor. And I think just defensively as well, Bogut has more intelligence, but he hasn't quite been sticking his nose in there as much after the concussion that he had. And Azeeley is a much better defensive rebounder at this point, too. So that's why I think I liked him a little bit better with the starters. But closing games, I think they found the right way, because I think Azeeley is still better with the reserves and Bogut is better with the starters. Like, Bogut is useless with the reserves, and Azeeley at least,
right,
you know, can hit the offensive glass and provide something. But I do think Azeeley should close games, and that's, in fact, what Golden State did. Without the availability of the death lineup.
Yeah, no, that's important to note that if against the vast majority of the teams, I think that Azeeley should not close because it should be the lineup of doom.
Well, so we probably talked a little bit too much about Golden State. What did you like about what Utah was able to do offensively in this game?
Again, they kind of did the stuff that if you're going to play bigger, you have to do. They did a really good job of using favors, especially to just, you know, and not doing kind of the I've got a smaller guy on me, ISO mismatch post up stuff that teams
and
do.
And favors actually, he's one of the few guys in the league. I mean, he does this. I've yet to see the power forward that can actually like keep him from backing down. And Green is a wonderful defender, but Favors has 50 pounds on the guy. And he's still quick enough, too, when you lean on him, that he can spin off you, which, you know, a lot of centers can't necessarily do.
But more kind of getting him the ball, like rather than from a static position, kind of getting him the ball on the move.
Yeah.
So he takes that one power dribble, kind of shoulders his way up through and finishes. And, you know, that, you know, allows him to use his size, strength, touch all at the same time in a way that doesn't let, you know, Green's low center of gravity and kind of general craftiness be as effective as it would be. And so they did a really good job of kind of getting him the ball sort of facing the basket, one power dribble and up kind of spots.
I thought Hayward killed Klay Thompson in this game too.
Hayward is good. You know,
yeah, he'd been slumping, and I think he's coming out of it now. But this is another one of these. I mean, I don't think I've really ever seen much evidence, either by watching or by statistics, that Klay Thompson is actually anything better than an average defender of scoring wings. I think he's pretty good on point guards, and he kind of takes pride in his ability on scoring wings, but those guys are just a little bit too athletic for him. He doesn't really have the ability to make them uncomfortable, and a lot of times they can just shoot right over him, you know, much like Harden did in the Western Conference Finals last year. We saw Hayward do a lot of that in this game.
I think, you know, I think Klay is better on kind of the runoff screens type score rather than the I have the ball, I'm going to break you down type scores, because then, like as you said, you know, some of the quickness comes into more of a factor. Whereas, you know, if he's excellent at, you know, at fighting through and around and over ball screens and dribble handoffs and stuff like that, but not quite as good as, you know, the best defenders kind of squared up on a guy one-on-one.
So going through the end of the game here, Utah was up by two. They run the pick and roll, get the favor switch on Steph. He hits just a ridiculous step back two going to his left on Favors to tie the game. And then what I thought was the key play of the game, Curry got a deflection on a pass, I think, to Favors, which he's awesome at. Like, that's actually one of the things that you will see now, is that guys just jump at passes defensively to make passes harder when there's, you know, anytime someone picks up the dribble, there's always a preemptive jump from whoever is guarding them. Like, that's something that you didn't see probably even, you know, 5-10 years ago.
It's the stop that, you know, it's the pass we're all so familiar of seeing for everyone running the pick and roll. You're going to the right. It's that kind of the pitch back over the shoulder to the opposite wing.
Right.
And that's in people are, like you said, it's I think Doug Eberhard calls it high hands defense, I think. And that's,
yeah.
And you're right. We are seeing a lot more of that.
Yeah. So he got his hands on it, and then Steph had a run out. I forget who it was, really, really hustled back to force actually a miss by Steph. But then Draymond Green was basically even with Rodney Hood. He beat Hood down the floor. Hood, for some reason, was jogging back, which was troubling because that play was right after a timeout. Like, there was no reason he should have been tired. And he jogged back just enough to foul Draymond as he was tipping the ball in. They were lucky that he missed the free throw. And then Utah came down and got two clutch free throws from Favors on one of those plays you were talking about, where he was able to kind of take a dribble and lower his shoulder and get fouled. And that's when the Golden State ran a nice little 1-2 pick and roll to get Hood on Curry. Burks was guarding him. And then Curry just puts him in the mix and pulls up for a three that basically, you know, was the game. Nobody else in league history that's a good shot for, and you just, like, you see Steph take that, and you're like, wow, we're screwed. We can't let him shoot this. It's just, there's nobody else like him.
And, you know, again, you say put Hood in the mix. Like, what exactly does Hood, could he have done differently there? Like, he played textbook defense on, and a guy is just, you know, it's too good.
I mean, I think on those plays, especially when you're not going against the death lineup, what I might try to tell whoever's guarding Steph is just look, like, defend him almost like you're just icing a pick and roll that isn't even there, and just say, all right, I'm going to just, you know, keep him on the, you know, on the left side of the floor or the right side of the floor. I think he's maybe just a little bit worse going to his right off the dribble, as most guys are. You know, keep him as close to the sideline as I can so that, you know, he can't make passes that easily, and just say, all right, we're going to help on the drive. You know, we're going to try and force him baseline, almost treat it like you're icing a pick and roll, even if there is no pick and roll, and just say, all right, you know, whoever's guarding Festus Ezeli, Draymond wasn't having a good shooting game. You know, maybe you just say, we're just going to try and run him off the three-point line as best we can and force him to help. But even though Hood was trying to do that, Steph just crossed him over anyway.
Yeah.
That's not like some cure-all. It's just, I think, the best you can do.
Right.
That's what I would tell him.
Just, yeah,
not that it's going to work.
Try to sit on his shooting shoulder, and then. But the problem is, he gets, like you say, he makes that one big step to his left, and like, well, I can't just turn him loose to the basket, can I? And so you look to recover, and then he crosses back, and it's not like he even beat Hood that badly. Like, Hood was right on the shot too, but his release is so quick and so pure, it doesn't matter right now. It was decent defense and just better offense.
Yeah, and then I liked what Hood, Utah did coming back. Hood got a great drive along the baseline and had a fantastic finish over Ezeli, who, like, did great verticality, chested him up. I thought there was no chance he was going to make that shot. And then Favors D'd up Steph pretty well on the switch. And then Hood got what was a pretty open three. Ezeli was able to come out of it, but they did a nice job having Gobert screen for Hood, and they just couldn't knock it down. Utah correctly sent everyone to the offensive boards, which you should do in a last shot situation, and Draymond Green just did an awesome job getting that last rebound.
Yeah, the one note is Utah did find themselves out of timeouts with when they missed that shot and Curry made the two free throws, which was...
When they were down three.
Yeah, and that's...
Well, I mean, was there a superfluous timeout that you felt shouldn't have been taken?
I'd have to go back through and see. It did not seem like the very end of the game was one where they called a bunch of timeouts in a row, though. So...
Yeah, and it is... The statistical evidence, from what I recall, is pretty mixed on using timeouts during the game. I think that generally, after timeouts, your efficiency is lower than it is after just a regular made. You feel like, all right, we have to stop a run, or maybe we need to get some subs in or something. But from what I've read, I've never seen anything that indicates that timeouts do any actually do anything to stop runs, but you kind of feel like you have to do it, I guess.
I actually looked at that a little bit this summer, and I found some possible evidence that they might stop runs a little bit, but it was equivocal. And as far as the other part about the efficiency coming out of timeouts, I contributed to a piece that's coming out this week somewhere that discusses this, and I won't spoil it further than that.
Okay, awesome. Let's move on to Chicago and San Antonio. I was at this game. I was actually my first time ever covering a game in my hometown, the United Center, which I was really fired up for. And there was yet another one of these games where the Bulls play a good team, often at home. You have no idea how the heck they're staying in the game and winning it. It looked in the first quarter like they were going to have no chance to score whatsoever, and San Antonio was going to win it like 90-72 or something. This is a Spurs team that's been defending, you know, at a ridiculous level so far this year, number one in the league in defense. And yet, you know, somehow Chicago pulls out yet another ugly win. They did a lot of this last year, and they've been doing it again this year, like most notably against the Thunder at home.
Yeah. It's the contrast in the style of, you know, the San Antonio is this kind of very, very mechanized, orderly, like all five play. One of my favorite things to watch about San Antonio, and it hasn't changed at all with Aldridge coming in, is if you watch when the change of possession happens, whether it's going from offense to defense or defense to offense, it's like all five guys turn and go at the same time, and it's like there's a almost a dog whistle or something like that. It's like, oh, time to go that way, it's quite beautiful actually, just to see it. And then whereas kind of Chicago is kind of sort of this rambling kind of ragtag of five guys running all over the place really hard, that was just an interesting like stylistic comparison. But then that kind of discombobulation of Chicago maybe ends up with them, you know, the ball kind of bounces weird and they get it and they get a layup off of a broken play. And like you, just enough of those, they stay in the game. And I guess you saw better than I did how they managed to pull it out tonight.
Yeah, they did. I'll go through a few of my notes. I think I'll start with San Antonio. They only had 20 assists on their 37 made field goals, only 2 of 14 from 3-point range. And really, they've been taking a surprisingly low number of threes this year, which is definitely something to watch. They're 2 of 14 tonight. It did not look like beautiful Spurs offensive basketball as much as you might expect. You still there?
Yeah.
Are you just muting
it?
Yeah, actually, it's probably better if you don't do that, just because you can kind of hear a little bit in the background, and it'll probably just highlight how much more of that background noise there is when you actually mute it.
Okay.
But I appreciate the sentiment nonetheless. All right, let me get back to the point I was making. And also, it distracted me because I thought that, like, you know, you were gone or something, and we'd gotten disconnected. All right, let me get back to what I was saying. They didn't really look like the Spurs that we've come to know in these last 4 or 5 years, except when they had Tony Parker running pick and rolls with LaMarcus Aldridge. They had a lot of effectiveness with that in the first half. Parker actually had 9 assists, looked pretty good himself. But a lot of what they did was Kawhi Leonard isolating. He had 21 field goal attempts, and he looked pretty good. He had some times where he was beating Jimmy Butler. He missed some easier shots that he might normally make as well. He got to the line for 9 attempts, but only 3 assists for him. He's not someone really who moves the ball, a lot of holding it when he gets it now. And I appreciate that from Popovich, but I think that's part of the growth process for Leonard. But this did not look like a Spurs team that was really, really difficult to stop in the way that they have in previous years, especially from the 3-point line.
Yeah, and that's I think part of that is Kawhi being a bigger part of their offense. This has been a thing kind of all year. But also, you know, you add Aldridge. I mean, he's I don't want to say a ball stopper, but he certainly isn't when he kind of gets the ball in his office. It's not necessarily.
Yeah. He didn't do a ton of that in this game. I mean, he probably only maybe had like four or five post-ups, I felt like, the whole game. It was mostly him, you know, killing on kind of mid-range jumpers off the pick and pop, and he was able to help Parker be pretty effective that way as well. I think he's getting away from that a little bit. I think it's more even Kawhi than it is Aldridge at times.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And that's, like you said, that's, I think, part of the natural growth. And you know, the thing that is, if of anything that's lacking behind for him, is the playmaking aspect, whether it's just moving the ball quickly or, you know, even creating for others when he is going off the dribble.
Yeah, and if I mean, he definitely, I don't mean to minimize what he's able to do one-on-one. He's really blossomed into a fantastic one-on-one scorer. And he made Jimmy Butler look really silly a couple of times tonight. But I think if I were defending him, I might play around with double-teaming him a little bit, especially when you have Duncan and Parker on the floor with him, not guys who are really huge spot-up threats, and see how he handles it. I think it would be very interesting to see that, because I don't think that's something that he has a ton of experience with, and usually, unless you just have kind of a preternatural ability, I mean, he's not someone who's ever really been double-teamed, you know, probably since high school, when he has the ball in his hands. That's something that takes time to learn. If I were an opposing coach, I would be looking at that very seriously.
Not just as a way to kind of stop their offense, but maybe to generate some turnovers also.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right, especially, you know, a San Antonio team that is tough to fast break on. A couple other observations. I thought Derrick Rose looked really, really slow throughout most of the game. It really kind of looked like just a guy. There were a couple of times when, you know, he got a burr in his saddle because Tony Parker was scoring on him a bunch late in the second quarter, and he kind of came back at him, but that was mostly with jump shots. He had a fast break where he, you know, the old Rose would have dunked it, and he just didn't. He had a couple of bursts, like when he blocked Parker's three-pointer at the end of the game, for example, and maybe, you know, he's just kind of in cruise control mode. He's coming back from this double vision thing, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it's at the point with him where, you know, he's got to prove that he's good still. And he just, you know, still doesn't quite look that way. But unfortunately, the late game offense is still very dependent on him, especially in a game where Butler was being totally swallowed up by Leonard.
Yeah, I think, at this point, don't we kind of have to think about Rose a similar way we think about a guy like Deron Williams?
I would love it if he were as good as Deron Williams.
Well, fair enough. But just in terms of, all right, that's what he was. This is what he is. Let's accept this and move on, because, you know, that guy is, you know, I'm obviously not the first person to say this, but that guy is gone, and he's there's just no evidence that's ever coming back, you know?
Yeah, the thing that's disappointing to me, though, is he looks worse physically after what was supposedly this whole summer of training. This is the first summer that hasn't been rehabbing, he's been able to work on training. He looks worse physically to me than he did last year. Last year, even, you would see, especially in a straight line, you would see the bursts. And we haven't seen at all this year him just, like, trying to run it down the throat of the defense. Like, he kind of tried it one time, wasn't able to turn on the Jets, and then Kawhi Leonard just stripped him in transition. It was, you know, kind of a depressing moment, frankly. But, you know, I think Fred Hoiberg would love it if he actually just, you know, even if there isn't a layup, just like the number of times that he actually dribbled fast up court in this game, you could count on one hand easily, even when he had some opportunities to do that. And the Bulls are not playing with pace. They're not getting any three-pointers. And part of that, too, is just that their spacing has been really bad. Part of it is, you know, they're playing Joakim Noah and Taj Gibson together. And not that they necessarily even shouldn't be doing that, but it's just that personnel is not particularly conducive. So when you look at all that, it's really, you know, this is not looking like it's going to be a good offensive team anytime soon, even though I thought Doug McDermott had a very nice game.
Yeah, on Rose's physical condition, he did break his face at the start of training camp, which probably, you know, I don't know how much, you know, no matter what you did all summer, if that's your first day of practice and then you do that, that's going to, there's going to be a setback.
He did have like 3 weeks where he wasn't able to condition at all. But I mean, it's just, and I think it's just part of it too, is he's just a little more fragile and takes longer to heal, and that's just how it is for him. You know, whether it's mental, whether it's physical, other than when he came back from that minor knee surgery for the playoffs last year, and actually I thought considering that performed pretty well over the course of the playoffs in the aggregate, and I was optimistic about him this year. So, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe he'll start to play better. I mean, he was a little bit better tonight at times, but, you know, I think it's counting on him to be good is probably not too great. But I thought McDermott actually had a very encouraging game from a defensive standpoint. He was actually guarding Manu Ginobili for large portions of the game, and he was able to stop Ginobili pretty well. His Hoiberg brought out the Hoibergo unit, which, for those who don't remember, is a unit without Mirotić, Gasol, Rose, or Butler. But I'm actually, and that unit actually was really effective, and I'm actually less against that unit now because it's not like any of those guys other than Butler have really been any good on offense anyway. So it's like, you know, you might as well just bring out a decent defensive unit. And they actually killed the Spurs when the Spurs went to the Boris Diaw, David West front court.
Sure. And this is, you know, the way we're talking about the Bulls seems like the way we've been talking about the Bulls for 5 years.
Like, they really are remarkably similar.
Yeah.
They really are. It's crazy. Other than the fact that McDermott is playing this year and we've seen less Gasol and Noah together, it's like the same team.
Yeah. It is kind of weird that even...
Worse, actually. I mean, they were 10th in offense last year and they're like 29th this year. and better defensively. Like, who would ever have thought that would have been the case? And their defense is good, by the way. Like, they did a great job. Even Pau, you know, was not too bad, especially, you know, when he's playing against a guy like Duncan where he doesn't have to roam too much, but he had some great help defense. He had a key block at the end of the game. And even Mirotić is a guy who's not that bad. I mean, I think he's kind of, you know, average, maybe a little below average in certain matchups, but I don't think that he's, like, some huge liability either.
Yeah, and this is, like you said, this is a decent matchup for Powell because it's not like, you know, they're going to put him in endless pick and roll. You know, something I was talking about over the weekend is kind of the Eat at Joe's sign that you know, flashes above certain big men's head, you know, at the end of the game where it's just like, oh, let's run a pick and roll. And Powell can be like that at times, but he's not like, you know, a Vucevic or a Enes Kanter in that way.
So a couple other notes on this I wanted to get to. Diaw and West was bad. A big part of that was West just really had a terrible defensive game when McDermott was kind of getting off in the second quarter. West was guarding Noah, and Noah was really effective with kind of his dribble handoffs and back doors, and West really should have been helping on those way more than he is. I mean, when you're guarding Noah, Noah is not a huge threat most of the time. But then actually Noah started getting some confidence. I think he had 7 assists in this game, and he actually had like a couple of crossovers, like plays off the dribbles, looking like the Noah from 2 years ago, really for the first time in at least a year that I can recall. So that was very encouraging for the Bulls, and he and Gasol actually played together some without being too horrible, especially going against San Antonio's two bigs. So it was encouraging for the Bulls in that respect, and they've defended very well in the clutch, despite the fact that they can't score at all. So that was certainly encouraging, and you know, maybe if Noah can kind of get back to a little bit to being the player that he was, then you can start thinking about the Bulls as a legitimate challenger for the sort of road tread team for Cleveland in the Eastern Conference Finals.
I mean, what has to happen for you to even think of, you know, kind of above that, or is such a thing like,
for the Bulls or for any
for the Bulls?
Oh gosh, I mean, they do have guys,
right?
Like, you know, if Rose could play a little better than he played in the playoffs last year, if Mirotić could start shooting 40% on threes. If they start playing McDermott a fair amount and he could not just get completely killed, defensively, which I thought today was a very encouraging sign on that score as well. I mean, there were some good things, although it still felt like the Bulls kind of lucked into this victory and the Spurs missed a bunch of easy shots. There were some encouraging
Chicago Bulls basketball.
Bulls. So, you know, if all those things happen and then they can keep defending at this level, I mean, you know, this team was a top 10 offense last year. I guess Dunleavy would have to come back also. There was really discouraging news that he had a setback today and he's going to only be, you know, he's going to basically do rehab for 2 weeks and then they're going to reevaluate and he's seeing a specialist. None of that is any good, to be sure. But if all those things can happen, I mean, if they keep up this defense and they can get back to being, you know, the number 10 offense in the league like they were last year, I mean, I can't think of any reason why that's impossible, although as you continue to pile up number 29 performances, it becomes less likely.
Right.
So, yeah, I do think it's possible. I think this is a team that does have a ceiling, and much like last year when they've played against some good teams, they've raised the level of their game and they've been able to kind of muck it up for these teams.
Yeah, I think that's the if one is looking for encouraging things, it's they haven't, you know, lost that kind of that bloody mindedness that that sort of characterized some of the Thibodeau teams. That like, you know what, we don't care. We're gonna dive on the floor, run into people, and we'll come up with enough plays to win somehow, some way. And just believing that and doing it is, you know, there's a certain unexplainable skill to that they had developed and perhaps still have in it of sorts, and that's not a bad thing.
All right, you want to do something? I didn't see this game at all, but you sound like you watched Miami Boston pretty heavily. What did you think about that game? You know, another Boston victory, which I'm sure was quite galling to you.
I don't know if that's galling. It's just
Who's at Miami?
Yeah,
too,
it was
right? Boston beat them by 10 at Miami.
It's I don't understand how it works. It's you know this team. I think, you know, on balance they're probably about where they should be. They're 10-8. But their games are full of fairly predictable.
Yeah, they either blow people out or get blown out. It's so odd.
Well, it's not just that. It's like, you know, the first 6 minutes of the game they're down 10 points. It's and it's because, you know, their greatest strength is they have, you know, this, you know, 1 through 11 flat talent, which means that at the start of every game, they have, you know, they're at a disadvantage against the other team's starters, and then you know, the mixing and matching starts and their bench comes in and there's no appreciable drop off, and the other team's bench comes in and there's a big drop off, and the Celtics come back and go on a run, and then Steven.
Yeah, but this has been a Miami bench that has been carrying them as
true.
Well. So
yeah.
I don't know that you can necessarily say that against this team.
But it's been the pattern of the Celtics kind of all year. And then kind of Stevens sort of, for the most part, figures out what is going to work on a particular night. And away we go. And even though tonight kind of showed one of the dangers of having all these options is that, you know, he has so many choices. There's a lot of wrong choices to make and kind of. In the second half, the backup point guard minutes went to Terry Rozier, and that did not go well for a couple minutes, and that allowed Miami back in the game a little bit. The other part of tonight, and part of this, as you pointed out to me on Twitter, is with Smart out, they didn't have anyone who could guard Dwayne Wade. But this was a kind of a throwbacky Dwayne Wade game where he was getting into the lane, he was getting out on the break. Kind of splitting the defense on the break and soaring in for dunks and just nice to see that he can still dial it up occasionally, even if kind of down the end. There was one unfortunate sequence where the play that kind of sealed the game with probably about 2 minutes left was Boston got an offensive rebound, kicked it out to Evan Turner, who was dribbling at the top of the floor. Amir Johnson was going to come set a ball screen, and Evan Turner waves the ball screen off so he can ISO on Dwayne Wade and just blows by him for just like completely, like doesn't even put like a much of a shake on him. Just like strong hand, straight line drive to the basket for a layup. And it's like that.
Yeah. I mean, and Evan Turner never gets by somebody in a straight line. Like that's why he's so vexing, is because he always kind of like has to spin back or like pull up for a tough J. From the free throw line. Yeah, well, it's I mean, Boston, do you buy what their defense has been doing, especially because they've continued to really, I think they have the highest turnover rate forced since like the 98 Celtics, which was that first Rick Pitino team that pressed all the time.
I don't think that's sustainable. I think they have a lot of guys who are good at getting their hands on the ball. I mean, with Smart, you know, you put a lineup with Smart and Avery Bradley and
Jay Crowder is a great steals guy. Yeah.
Like you're gonna get your hands on a lot of balls there. So that's and you know, Sullinger has good hands and Amir Johnson, and so you know I can
see. Yeah, I mean, they forced another 18 turnovers tonight.
So I can see them being all season being really good at coming up with steals, which is for a team that has some fairly severe half court offensive limitations. It's going to be pretty important to get those kind of transition opportunities. But whether they can be, you know, that good at it, you know, historically good at it all season, you know, in general, I don't like to predict historical greatness. So I'm going to be skeptical that really sustains over the course of a season.
Yeah. How did Hassan Whiteside play in this game? He looked like he didn't,
Didn't
have much of an impact.
I think it's, you know, they kind of stretched him out away from the basket a little bit. Sullinger hit some jump shots on him, and then they kind of went away from him and went with, you know, more mobility, whether it was they played a lot of Bosch McRoberts together, it seemed like. And I think part of that is they just weren't really, with Wade, especially Wade getting it going, they weren't necessarily able to get him involved offensively, and then as his wants maybe checked out defensively a little bit, and so just wasn't a night where he was going to give them a lot.
Yeah, it does seem like he is a guy who's a little bit dependent on his offense to kind of get going defensively.
Yeah.
All right, that's probably long enough for today. We can get into some of the news maybe on tomorrow's episode. You got anything to plug before we go?
Just doing a lot of, I've been over the weekend, did a lot of work getting kind of a lineup and positional playing time estimates up and running at Nylon Calculus for the year. I'm working on an argument right now suggesting that Draymond Green is the best center in the NBA this year. So, So look for that. If I can make an aside, there was one thing I wanted to mention when we were talking about the Golden State Utah, which I forgot to.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
So you and Danny were talking about teams that could be, you know, teams with cap space upcoming, which could be buyers, and why not Utah?
Oh yeah, we've talked about that in the offseason. I mean, they could have 35 million in space, but I mean, I guess the question is, what do they need?
They need another big.
Third big who can shoot.
A third
would
big,
be great.
Probably, you know, one more perimeter guy, preferably a point guard, but just one more perimeter guy in general. And it's almost to me, it seems like getting a guy who's under contract for next year is kind of pre-spending that cap space on a player who is on a contract better than they could get a similar player in this market would be the way I think about it. In Utah, you know, almost no matter how good they are this season, probably not still a prime free agent destination. So that would seem like, you know, they have extra first coming their way, I believe, from Golden State, correct?
It's from Golden State and also from the Thunder in the Enes Kanter trade.
Yeah, so they
they have 2017 first, unprotected from Golden State, and then top 15 protected, I believe, is the Oklahoma City pick, but that doesn't convey until 2018 at the earliest. Yeah. That's off the top of my head, but I think that's right.
Yeah, so they have you know some chips to go with to go. So that I don't. It's tough to see who's going to be available this early to that would fit kind of what they want. But they can and perhaps should be a player, both for this season and going forward.
I think a lot of it just depends where they end up, too. You know, if they get the 8th seed, the 7th seed, they win 44 games, then I think you're like, all right, you know, we're just going to bring back Dante Exum and Trey Burke, and that'll be good enough at point guard, and kind of see what we can sign you know, in the bargain bin and free agency, or you know, let Trey Lyles develop. But if you get to, all right, we're the fifth seed in the West and we won 50 games this year, then you say, all right, it's time to be a little bit more aggressive than that, and maybe even really see if we can get into that top rung of the contenders. Now, there aren't really any point guards available. Maybe Darren Williams could maybe come back. I think the way Darren has played in Dallas, he probably wouldn't want to do that. And then maybe like Ryan Anderson is the other guy who kind of comes to mind. But I think
Terrence Jones,
everybody and their brother.
If Houston, if stuff starts to, you know.
I don't think he really fits into their culture or that much what they're trying to do, you know, with his lack of shooting. I would be surprised there if they went after him. I mean, maybe like a Donatas Mata-Yunas would be a little bit more likely to prove that he's healthy.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously with the restricted, that's always, that's going to be really weird this year, especially with the long moratorium.
No, but I'm thinking, I'm talking in terms of like a trade, you know,
since they have those picks.
If go out and get, you know, like a, you know, a Terrence Jones or, I mean, again, if Houston continues to, we didn't really get into that game, but they had kind of a desultory loss to Detroit tonight, would you say?
Well, they were down 60-32 at one point. So, yes, I would consider that desultory.
Yeah. All right. So that was just, I just kind of wanted to bring that up as a.
No, this is an exciting team. And, you know, I think that they're still kind of hovering around 500, but they've had this really road heavy, difficult schedule. And I don't know about you, I fully expect them to really kind of kick it into high gear on this upcoming homestand and start playing really well.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I don't think they've played especially badly to be where they are record wise now. I think they've played decently well, and it's only going to be, figuring out how to get enough offense without kind of a true creator on the floor, and just getting their offense moving a little faster will help them do that, I think.
Yeah. All right, man. I'm going to let you go. You can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth Partnow, PARTNOW. I am Nate Duncan, NBA. If you want to support the program, you could buy some Stance socks, or there's also the cap space promo codes on DraftKings and SeatGeek. Actually, my uncle went to the game today. He bought his tickets on SeatGeek. Also, you could like my Facebook page at Nate Duncan NBA. You can keep up with my writing there. I'm not nearly as prolific as Seth is, but I do have a piece coming out tomorrow looking at film and the numbers on players who are coming back from season-ending injuries this year that I hope you will enjoy. So you can look for that, and we'll talk to you all next time. Thanks.